This is a People First Radio podcast.
CHLY 101.7 FM, Vancouver Island. On the web, www.chly.ca.
Xander Sherman is a young freelance writer with a special interest in education issues. His debut book, The Curiosity of School, examines some of the most controversial current debates about the topic of education. Xander has also examined other themes and situations, from reporting on a murder investigation to looking at trends in student housing. But a highly personal family situation has become the focus of his most recent article. That article has been described as a harrowing story of brotherly love, and it reveals what happened when Xander's brother Joshua disappeared several years after he suffered a drug-induced psychotic break. The BC trip that saved my brother's life was published in the Vancouver Sun on September 26, 2015. It describes how Xander searched for his brother Josh, 32 years old, 6 foot 1 inch tall, 130 pounds, brown hair, blue eyes, homeless since July 2015, and eventually found him in a province with more homeless people than any other in Canada. Here's my interview with Xander Sherman.
Xander, 5 years ago, your brother Joshua experienced a psychotic break. What happened at that time?
What happened was that in 2006, when my brother Joshua was 23, he moved to Nelson from Ontario, where our parents and I live. And he moved out there to go to college to study music and guitar production. And he was always a very bright, talented, creative person, the healthiest person I knew. Not just physically, he was in top shape, but mentally and emotionally, he was just such a positive, happy guy. So he moved to Nelson in 2006, and things were going fine. He was getting good marks. He was president of his school's student union, million friends. And then we started getting kind of strange emails from him about a year into his coursework, and one of those emails in 2007 was to our father, and it said, "Hey Dad, I spilled some coffee on the couch, and I attached a photo so you can check it out." And what it was his name written in large uppercase letters, painted on with a paintbrush dipped in coffee, across, I don't know, like 8 feet of white upholstery. And that was just something that we noticed. It was a red flag, and we definitely took note of it. But the thing was, because he had been so healthy, we didn't think it was a mental health issue. Like, it was Joshua? No way. Like, it was just, it wasn't in our minds. It was nowhere near the realm of possibility. We just thought it was sort of a random episode. But then over the next couple of years, there were more emails, strange emails. He was convinced that he had H1N1 when that whole thing was going on. And we visited him. He came back here, and he seemed okay. But then in 2010, or by 2010, he still hadn't graduated. So he's 4 years into a two-year program, still no graduating. And he just abruptly, that spring, moved from Nelson to Vancouver Island and stayed with our relatives because he said he wanted to start a rock band. And, you know, this was with no repertoire of songs, no bandmates, no practicing, no practice space, nothing like that. So it was just kind of wild fantasy. And then he was so unruly that our relatives asked him to actually leave their place. So he was just kind of staying with friends and people for a few weeks. We didn't really hear from him. And then in August of 2010, he phoned our mother's house saying that there were voices in his head and he needed to come home. So that was the beginning. That was his drug-induced psychotic break.
Can you tell us more about the notion of drugs and psychosis? What did you learn? Did you look into that a little bit?
Well, after he came back, like, we didn't know at the time that it was a drug-induced psychotic break. He was flown back to Ontario, and his behavior was, you know, there's a wholesale transformation. His eyes were bulging. His speech was different. He was aggressive, obviously delusional and paranoid. But he didn't know that he was ill. he didn't know that something bad had happened to him. So we had to convince him to go to a doctor. And when we did, it was just a teleconference with a doctor in Toronto, which is about 2 hours from where we live in Muskoka. And the doctor's prognosis at that point was that he'd had a drug-induced psychotic break. But he said, you know, there's no underlying condition here. He just needs to rest and recover. Then things will be fine, and you don't need to worry. And then from there, he just got worse and worse.
You write in your account that psychosis, if left untreated, can lead to schizophrenia. Did then schizophrenia manifest in Joshua's life? And if so, how?
Yeah, so psychosis is it's just a cluster of symptoms. It's not a diagnostic category. So like paranoia and auditory hallucinations, despondency, those are all symptoms of psychosis. But if Joshua had an underlying medical condition, there was no sign of it in childhood, and there's no history of mental illness in my family. So basically what happened was he just smoked a lot of pot. And whenever I tell that to people, they're astonished. They're like, no, like what, really pot? And people don't know this, but it's a serious drug. And there's nothing wrong with the plant, but there's a lot that's wrong with the way that it's made and modified. And in my brother's case, this drug-induced psychosis, which was triggered by pot, just went untreated, and it turned or developed into schizophrenia. And the way that I could tell that it had developed into schizophrenia was, it sounds kind of weird, but he had like long since blocked us from Facebook, but I could still privatize my web browser and go in and look at his cover photos, his like publicly available cover photos. And I noticed that at first the images were just kind of dark. There were a lot of selfies and kind of moody dark pictures that were disturbing but like still rational. And then about a year ago I noticed that there was just a sudden deterioration. The pictures were completely random. He was taking photos and affecting them using an online editing application. He wasn't distinguishing between people and like stock images of Kraft peanut butter. It was really shocking, and I know it's not medically sound to say, but like as a brother, I just knew at that moment that he was schizophrenic.
Joshua went missing, and then you began to search for him. How did you find Joshua?
So my brother left Ontario in the summer of 2014. So just over a year ago, he left Ontario for the last time. He had been ping-ponging between Ontario and BC, staying with friends, relatives, strangers, people he just met. And the last time he left Ontario was last summer. And we had assumed that he would go back to Nelson, and we had some contacts in that area. People that we knew and who knew Joshua and who were deeply concerned about him. Some really, really wonderful people. And they helped us by saying when they had seen him. So a few weeks ago, one of these people, one of these contacts, emailed me and said, I saw your brother. He looks really bad. I actually spoke to him, and it sounds like he has trench foot, which is a painful condition of the feet that can lead to amputation if it's not medicated. My brother can't be relied on to take medication. He's never taken medication in his life. So that was really the turning point. And she said, by the way, your brother's living in a tent. He was in a homeless shelter, and now he's been kicked out of the shelter, and he's living in a tent in Nelson. This is in September, and it gets cold there in September. And I can tell that at night it was dropping down, and you know, facing another Canadian winter and my brother's deteriorating physical as well as mental health, I knew that I had to do something. And so I got on the plane and went.
There were some barriers. You might say, in a larger sense, these barriers can prevent anyone from helping their mentally ill loved ones. You encountered some barriers. How did you overcome those?
Right. So the biggest barrier to helping a mentally ill person is is the law. And that sounds kind of funny and backward, but it's true. Right now, the law isn't set up to allow family members to intervene unless their mentally ill loved one becomes a danger to themselves or to other people. In BC, there's another clause I know in the Mental Health Act that does say someone can be involuntarily admitted to a hospital, like if they're just in bad shape. But that clause, I had tried to use that clause to get my brother involuntarily admitted when I was still in Ontario. I was emailing with the Nelson police, quoting the law to them and arguing that my brother qualified under those grounds or conditions, and they said no, that they wouldn't pick him up unless he became a danger to himself or to other people. So that's really the main criteria by which someone can be involuntarily admitted, which I think is really a travesty. I know there are people out there who are against involuntary admission, but I really think that, like, I don't know, abortion or same-sex marriage, it's one of those issues that unless you're personally connected to, you really don't have the experience with which to make an informed decision. The people who are against involuntary admission are basically condemning people like my brother to die, because that's the alternative. If I hadn't gone out there and found my brother and had him form nines and sent to the hospital, he would, he'd still be on the streets right now, and he'd be headed for destruction.
You wrote that after your brother Joshua had been placed into a psychiatric facility, and I'm quoting you, his worst fears about us had all come true. I had followed him out there. I had talked to people behind his back. Unquote. Tell us more, Xander, about that difficult reality. And there's a kind of an unreality link to it. His fears that you would come out and do this behind his back.
My brother was paranoid about our parents. He was so paranoid about them and delusional. He thought that we were kicking him out of the family. He thought that our father was a neurolinguistic programmer who was using hypnosis to remote control his mind. He thought that our mother had kept him in a dungeon as a child. His delusions had grown to just epically sad and profound lengths. And so we knew if we went out there and tried to find him that he would see us, because Nelson is a really small town, and he would run away. And then our concern was that from there he would go somewhere where we didn't know, because at least at this point we still knew he was in Nelson. So that was really a debate that we had for a long time, my parents and I. Do we go to Nelson and try to find him? If we do find him, will he run away? Should we just leave him alone and let the hope that the system catches on? And then finally, I'd had enough. I just couldn't take it anymore. And I just felt this fraternal obligation, this almost biological impulse to go at this particular time in September, when we had heard that he was living in a tent, and do whatever I could to get him committed, even though he was delusional, even though if he saw me, he would run away. I just stopped caring. I just stopped. The desire to help him overpowered the fear of him seeing me.
What can you tell us about Joshua now?
Well, we don't know very much, and that's kind of another problem. I think that families of people with serious mental illnesses should be given information about their care and treatment, regardless of the person's preferences. My brother doesn't want us to know anything about his treatment, but that shouldn't matter. And I think that because I believe that mental health, like all aspects of being, is shared. We get a say in whether we're mentally healthy, but we don't get the only say. And we should listen to people, family members, loved ones, spouses, siblings, to tell us when we're unwell. And the law should reflect that sense of shared responsibility and well-being. So apart from that, we know that Joshua is in a long-term facility in the province of BC. We know where, but I don't think I should say where. for the time being, his doctors and nurses are his family, and he's asked them not to include us in his life or his treatment. He is on medication for the first time in 5 years, and so for the first time in that amount of time, there is reason to be hopeful.
Xander, what would you like to say to other families and individuals who face similar circumstances as yours?
Every case is so different. I would just say never give up. Never stop trying to help someone you love, even if they don't want to be helped. Never give up or back down. The system is broken, so it becomes our responsibility on a personal level to do everything we can to those we are tied to by blood or through love.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, I just wanted to say thank you for your time and thank you to everyone for listening.
Xander Sherman is a freelance writer with a special interest in education issues. You can find out more about his debut book, The Curiosity of School, online at thecuriosityofschool.com. And you can read the personal account of Xander's search for his brother Joshua online at the Vancouver Sun. Just search for Xander Sherman and Vancouver Sun.
People First Radio is an initiative of Vancouver Island Mental Health Society in partnership with Radio Malaspina Society and broadcast on CHLY 101.7, radio from Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed are not necessarily those of the partnering organizations. Listen to People First Radio on demand. Just Google People First Radio to find our web pages.